back again, hopefully with my guest live and audible to all of you. Are you there, Karen?
I am indeed. I can hear you perfectly.
Very good. Yeah, you're looking good here as well. Thanks very much for coming and joining us on TNS.
My pleasure.
And I was saying earlier on that we met at the Be the Change meeting that we both attended in Birmingham.
That's right.
And you basically told us the story of your time as a nurse, which was a real eye opener to me. So I'm hoping to cover some of that ground this evening with you. It was some while ago that you trained, wasn't it?
Yeah, I first started training as a student nurse when I was 19. I finished secondary school. I was educated in Ireland and did my nurse training in Dublin in a hospital called Dr. Stephen's Hospital, which is sadly no more. And I worked in Ireland until 1987. There was a terrible recession in Ireland in 1987. And nearly everybody who I trained with as a nurse and who I grew up with as a teenager emigrated at that stage because there was so little work to be had, and I came to England and initially worked in Tunbridge Wells, and then my career kind of ended up with me staying in England for much longer than I planned, and I guess one of the things that was noticeable was that the way that we trained then as a nurse was so different to what nursing now is. When I was a student nurse, the education involved 6-week blocks of lectures, talks, demonstrations, discussions, and then you'd go and work on the ward throughout your 3 years of your training. So you got a lot of clinical experience while you were being educated, and you were a supernumerary part of the workforce. So you really got a lot of experience, and what it meant was that by the time you qualified, you were pretty much able to hit the ground running when you were working on the wards or whichever area that you chose to work in. I eventually ended up specializing in operating theatre nursing, and the reason that I came to England was so that I could do a specialist course to get a qualification that was from the English Nursing Board at the time, and it was the EMB 176, which was a year spent in King's College Hospital, learning all of the intricacies and specialist requirements for being a nurse for patients who were mostly unconscious at that time. And I think it was one of the things that we spoke about at the meeting when we first met a few weeks ago. Was one of the things that was really reiterated for us was that our principal role was that of the patient's advocate. Although nurses don't take any sort of Hippocratic oath, the organizations, the professional organizations that we're registered with have codes of conduct. And first and foremost amongst those, even now, it's supposed to be that you will protect your patients. And I think that that was one of the kind of eye-opening experiences that recently kind of led to me becoming a whistleblower and having such problems within the NHS.
There must have been quite a few changes, weren't there? Putting the patients first was, I take it your training would have been substantially different from the training that's going on now?
Well, it's changed several times. I've been here since 1987. So even up until 1997, I took a career break in 1997. And there were Project 2000 nurses. So the training for nurses who were going to qualify in 2000 was substantially different. It was more based in the university. So I think that it was perceived that student nurses were being used as a crucial part of the workforce when really they weren't qualified to be that. So the intention was to balance it out a little bit. And there had been a drive for it to be a degree-based profession. I think there's some disagreement within the nursing profession about whether or not that's necessary or appropriate. But there seemed to be a lot of people within the leadership of nursing who felt that nurses needed to be respected much more, that they deserved equal respect to doctors And a way to do that was to change the way the training was provided and delivered.
And that meant moving it off the shop floor, as it were, and into a more theoretical realm.
Yeah, and interestingly, one of the things that often caused some tension within the clinical area with students was that educators were instructing students to question everything. That what had been observed was that there were lots of practices that were just traditional rather than evidence-based.
Okay, so they
research-based.
They'd sort of come through from history, as it were, rather than being sort of approved.
Yes, yeah. And so often students would come through, and I think the way that they would ask those questions often was perhaps there would be bad timing. If you're in the middle of doing something really vital and somebody kind of, can I just stop you there? Why are you doing that? You shouldn't really be doing that. Often the appropriateness of those interjections from somebody who had no clinical experience often caused some disharmony.
Yeah.
Between the students who up until that point probably were being more amalgamated into the workforce, into the team of nurses and professionals who were delivering care to patients, in my opinion. It's peculiar because the emphasis seemed to go from compassion for the people who were being cared for, and it swung more in the direction of academia. And realistically, in order to be a nurse, I think that's the reason a lot of people become nurses is that they've experienced the kindness of nursing. Somebody in the family has been unwell, or a parent is a nurse, and so people become nurses because there's an element, well, certainly when I was training as a nurse, there's a vocational element to it, you know, it's kind of what you're born to do almost if you're a particular personality. And when I trained, it was completely a female profession. The only male nurses were psychiatric nurses in Ireland at that time. It's very different now, obviously.
That's quite a major change, isn't it? It's also certainly true that the people I knew when I was younger, because I don't really know any nurses now, but when I was younger I did, and they were all people who actually appreciated the fact that they were going to be getting hands-on experience as their training or as part of their training. They went specifically for it because it was something that was going to enable them to get in there and start helping straight away.
Yeah, and I think that was a big shock for a lot of people, that's not what their experience was. And indeed, even once they got onto the wards, that the role of the nurse has changed so completely. So much of it is administration, and those elements of patient contact and patient care have been delegated now to healthcare assistants. And indeed, I think we talked about this as well. In Ireland, when I was applying to be a student nurse, it was very difficult to become a student nurse. The educational requirements meant that you needed to have at least 3 honours in your final exams. We used to do the Leaving Certificate. So generally, you would have studied anywhere between 7 and 10 subjects for your final exams in secondary school. You had to have a qualification in maths, in English and biology, as well as several others. And in fact, it's become even more difficult to become a nurse now. It's quite incredible the educational standards of nurses, of people going into the nursing profession in Ireland, is very, very high. And I think it's one of the changes that's immediately apparent when you work in England, is that the same requirement doesn't apply. When I was doing my theatre course, I think there were only 7 of us on that course, and 3 of the nurses who trained in England had no maths qualification whatsoever, which can be tricky when some of the care that you're giving requires you to be able to do simple mathematical calculations.
Yeah.
And I sometimes wonder about that. The kind of dumbing down of the workforce means that you have essentially something that is female dominated, and women who are in a caring profession. You have a group of people who are often not militant at all and still have that desire to really be caring and compassionate and would never take any sort of industrial action or any sort of action to kind of protect themselves as workers. If conditions change, as conditions have changed considerably over the years. So you have a very kind of compliant workforce, I think. And I wonder sometimes, is that a deliberate strategy?
Well, I think to a certain extent that probably starts, doesn't it, by removing, if people are coming for training, by putting them in for some period of academic training before you let them do what their heart is asking them to do. You are allowing yourself time to separate them from the caring that they want to do, aren't you? And that must be the start of what seems to then be a process.
Yeah, and I think if perhaps the emphasis becomes academic rather than caring, and if your experience of people is diluted so that you don't really get to meet patients in the way that you spent so much time on the wards interacting with patients and giving care and learning how to be with patients, and really seeing them as people rather than conditions.
Yeah.
That your connection to them and that sense, which was really encouraged in the hospital that I trained in, was that your responsibility first and foremost was to those patients, not to your manager, not to your employer, not to anything like that, but as if the person you're looking after is your relative.
And was that recognized by the management?
I don't know. I think at that stage, those attempts to introduce some of the sort of management efficiency drives that you see now and that have been in existence since the 90s, perhaps, weren't happening. There may have been some changes happening, and there may have been a perceived need to make things more efficient or to make things happen faster, to make the patient journey through hospitals faster. But those kind of nurses weren't responsible, for example, for the budget, or the management was the management of the patients and management of the team of staff, not the money to deliver the services to the patient or within the division. So that emphasis was very different. You know, if you failed to meet a target, there was no sense that you were going to be out of pocket. I remember once I had qualified, I worked in a particular area. This was in Ireland, in fact. It wasn't completely perfect over there by any means.
I'm surprised there's such a difference between England and Ireland. It's quite marked, isn't it?
Completely different. At that stage, completely different. There were nurses' aides, but no healthcare system. There were hospital porters. A newish professional group within the disciplines of people who deliver care in hospitals, called operating department practitioners, and they were City and Guild trained when I first encountered them, and then they became NCVQ trained, and I think now they're also attached to universities, and they are trained, for example, specifically to work within operating theatres, and in England there were enrolled nurses, as well as registered nurses. Now, in Ireland, there were only nurses. The workforce was really very undiluted. There was one particular professional level, and those professionals were expected all to meet, at the very least, a minimum safe standard. You're encouraged to strive for excellence, of course, but part of that also came from the indoctrination of your responsibility. In Ireland, if I recall correctly, many of the Dublin hospitals were run by religious orders. So you either had voluntary hospitals or you had religious order hospitals. That's all changed a lot now. But again, that kind of ethos was partly behind the delivery of nursing care.
Yeah. And was it supportive to, you know, because obviously when people are learning to do things, they do make mistakes. Was it supportive of that, and did it make any attempt to kind of take it on board and sort it out?
If I'm completely honest with you, I think it's only in recent years that I've become aware of some of the terrible, terrible accidents that can happen to patients in hospitals. And when I say recent years, I mean in the last 20. I've been a nurse since 1985. Yeah, I'm afraid that's accurate.
So presumably things started to change quite quickly after your training, did they, after you qualified?
Well, perhaps some of it is my awareness. I don't want to paint the picture of Ireland being a country where no incidents happen. That would be incorrect. But once I came to work in England, I became involved in educating students, and I also became a steward for the Royal College of Nursing. So as a result of that, I was much more aware of incidents and accidents that happen in hospitals and the NHS. And as a teacher, I do research into cases where nurses were brought before the Nurses and Midwives Council, which is our regulatory body, which might lead to them being struck off the register for failure to care for a patient or leading to an injury of a patient.
So you've actually got quite a lot of third party experience in this sort of thing. You've seen other people going through the process.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's amazing how it can be quite simple things. That some of the kind of horror stories that you would hear would be through a real, like it would perhaps a genuine human mistake compounded by somebody's desire to protect themselves. So, for example, a story that I heard of an incident that happened in a hospital I once worked in was where a student nurse was running for a case. She was a circulating nurse for an operation. And at the end of the case, when they counted all the instruments to make sure all the instruments had been removed safely from the patient, the student said, "I think we're missing an artery forceps." And the person who was scrubbed up as a qualified nurse really attacked her. "How dare you? Are you implying I don't know how to do my job?" And she said, "You know, when we started off, there were only 9 of these, and we have 9 now. That's absolutely correct." And what transpired was that she then went and got a replacement forceps and put a 10th forceps on the tray so that it looked complete when it was processed for sterilization later. But that patient subsequently died because indeed a forceps had been left inside the patient and she hadn't communicated it to the surgeon. And obviously, if she'd done what she should have done, when that count was identified, something was missing, she should have said to the surgeon, "I'm missing an instrument. We need to find it. Don't close up the patient." Yeah. And if he wasn't able to find it, they'd have x-rayed the patient. So there are standard practices in place that are national standards, so that if something like that happens, everybody knows what you're supposed to do. So I think my first experiences of clinical incidents were when somebody made a mistake and was too afraid to admit it.
And that's
something like that.
Yeah, that is something that that we'll probably get onto, I would imagine, because it is recognized by the system that people do try to hide their own mistakes, and that's why I think that as we get further on in the story, we realize that there are supposed to be ways of people who are noticing deficiencies in the system to bring it to the surface, but. This wasn't specifically the case in these days, was it? I mean, you spent your early years, you spent first some time in the King's College Hospital and then you moved into a private hospital, didn't you?
That's right. I worked in London, and that's where I first, I got my first sister's post in that hospital. I worked there for many years running an operating theatre, dealing with all sorts of emergency surgery, elective surgery, also having a steady stream of students coming through, so teaching learners of all levels of ability as they came through that operating theatre.
And was that just that's teaching and it's sort of fairly senior position in the running of the theatre, isn't it?
Yeah, I was a G grade sister, so this was just at the time when the grading system had been introduced to nursing. So I was. It's probably not the most senior level that a clinical nurse can get to, but at the time it was much higher than I'd expected to get at that age. I think I was in my 20s at that stage. But I think I was completely devoted to my career. I was a workaholic. I was there all the time and loved the work, loved the constant change of it and the different sort of specialities that you'd see coming through, because there's so many different types of surgery that can be carried out in person for each system of the body, that it was a constant learning experience.
And you get to do the whole thing in a single theatre, so you have to understand all of this to a degree.
Yeah, and in fact, in those days, We had a very old operating theatre. When I first saw the operating theatres, I really couldn't believe it. They were awful. They were really old-fashioned, and they had kind of tiled walls and drains in the floor. You'd hose down the walls at the end of the day to clean the place. So it was very old-fashioned. The hospital I trained in Dublin, in fact, had a very modern set of operating theatres recently built. So it was absolutely top of the line. So it felt like I'd moved back in time when I first went into those theatres. But at the time, we put the patient to sleep in the anaesthetic room, which was attached to the operating theatre. And then there was a little room on the other side where the nurse who had assisted with the surgery also recovered the patient as they came around from their anaesthetic before they were transferred back to the ward. So your experience was very broad, and you kind of became very expert. And it takes a considerable number of years to become expert in theatre nursing, number one, and then in a particular speciality of theatre nursing.
Yeah.
So for example, I worked in a vascular theatre, and we also did liver surgery and pediatric neonatal, so children and tiny babies. Mm-hmm. But it took years and years to really become expert in all of the different procedures, because some procedures you'd only see once or twice a year, some conditions would only show up once every couple of years. So at that stage, the team of nurses who you had working in that operating theatre, you often had a core of nurses who stayed there for quite a number of years.
And they effectively formed a sort of cooperative community then, sharing information and basically at least having the time to offer mutual support and that.
Yeah, and often as the manager of that unit, you would be very well aware of your team's strengths and weaknesses and abilities. So if you had recruited a good team, a good reliable team around you, you were able to manage that very well. And that was really helpful, because it meant that you really created a very safe environment for each other and for the patients coming into the unit, as well as the surgical teams visiting to do their particular type of surgery.
And did you have the resource to do the recruitment required?
For the first few years, that wasn't such a problem. But in subsequent years, and I've said this to you before, when I came in 1987, I think the Tories had been there for a while. By the time I left King's in 1997, the Tories were in the process of dismantling the NHS, and they had really reduced the numbers of student nurses coming through training schools and colleges. So there weren't enough qualified nurses coming through the system in the United Kingdom to fill all the vacancies that we required. So I think in 1997, I traveled to Finland with a group of other managers recruiting nurses from Finland. Because we just weren't able to get the qualified staff that we needed. And of course, in London, as you can imagine, it was incredibly expensive to live there and to find affordable accommodation for the staff that you recruited. So there were all sorts of challenges for that. And in 1997, we hadn't perhaps gone quite as far as traveling to the Philippines to recruit nurses, which certainly was happening by 2003, maybe 2002, 2004.
Did you get to see any of the systems you were hiring nurses from, or was it simply an administrative thing?
How do you mean?
Did you get to see how they worked over there, or did they have a surplus of nurses, or in places?
Well, the NMC, it was the UKCC at the time, it's changed its name, had a process where it recruits, this is what happened with the second kind of, or the third influx of foreign nurses, where the NMC had a process where in order to register with the registering body, certain criteria had to be filled. And once they met the criteria and could be registered, then you would interview them and perhaps employ them, unless the hospital recruited them en masse, at which point it was kind of potluck. So when you had the luxury of people who had similar training backgrounds and who you were aware of the quality of their training and their ability to speak English fluently. And at the time, I don't think we appreciated that was a luxury. But now, in hindsight, that was really a luxury.
That was a change that happened quite rapidly over 4 or 5 years, really, that you went from being able to recruit and pay for the people you needed to having your team to a certain degree thrust upon you as a bulk buy.
Well, and I don't know if that was everybody's experience, but certainly it was noticeable from the beginning of my career and my having the role of recruiting staff towards the end, where I would find myself working with people who I wasn't really certain that they were really nurses.
Right. So eventually,
and that's tricky.
Eventually you decided to give it a bit of a break.
Well, in 1997, I decided to have a career break, and I was still in London. I stayed there and I did an art degree in Goldsmiths College, which was fantastic. It was just completely using different sides of my brain, or different parts of my brain. There was just so much conversation happening and so much curiosity and a real spirit of exploration, and it was very creative. And I think it was only when I was a student and studying something so creative that I realized how little I was expected to use my initiative as a nurse, because it's a very hierarchical profession and discipline to be in a hospital. I think when I first began nursing, nurses were often challenging the perception of the profession as the handmaidens of the doctor.
Yeah.
So that was quite difficult, I suppose, in a way, dealing with that as a professional, that there was another profession that was really battling to keep people as the handmaiden, as their handmaiden. But anyway, it was only when I was at college and watching my fellow students suffer the stresses of approaching deadlines, where I would find myself saying all the time, listen, what's the worst that can happen? No one's going to die.
Yeah.
Because up until then, that had been my measure of worst case scenario, is if we screw this up, someone could die. And I think that is a day-to-day possibility in any hospital looking after any patient. The simplest of errors can kill somebody.
And that's a responsibility that's technically being taken on by every single person, individual in there.
Well, certainly the professionals, those people who don't fall into the category of a professional. So perhaps healthcare assistants, for example, while they have some responsibility. I mean, really, it's quite incredible the amount of nursing tasks that have been delegated down to that level of worker. And again, it's about this dumbing down of the workforce. Really don't want to offend any healthcare assistants. There are many healthcare assistants who have more compassion in their little fingers than some of the senior nurses who I've worked with over the years. They often want to be in a hospital, and perhaps the reason they're there is they didn't have the qualifications to do nursing sometimes.
Yeah.
But the people who are responsible for ensuring patients are safe are those people who take over the patient's care, and that role of being the advocate for the patient. So particularly in areas where somebody is, any area of a hospital, if you come into a casualty and outpatient department, an operating theatre, an intensive care ward, the least you can expect is that you won't come to any harm. And I think that's reasonable. And unfortunately, I think what I've witnessed in the profession over the years, not just in the nursing profession, but in other professions, is a real change in that feeling of personal accountability and responsibility, where people feel so disempowered that they don't take responsibility for their actions, and some people, I can understand this, they feel that they've attempted to create a culture where it's safe or where there's good communication, and their managers don't listen to them, don't support them, don't help them. Indeed, they're perceived as troublemakers. So eventually, you can't fight every day of your life at work. People just give up and say, okay, I've done my bit. I've tried to make a change here and I can't. It's not my responsibility. Or indeed, you have people who just aren't there for the same reasons. Maybe there is a small element of people working in all of those professions, where they're there to just earn a wage. And that's an unusual reason, I think, to be in a hospital. And indeed, for some doctors, not just to earn a wage, but to become millionaires. So if the motivation isn't good, isn't isn't caring, then things can go horribly wrong.
And the motivation has become over the years one almost entirely of money at one level or another. And whilst we might have had the impression that this was, I mean, I did have the impression that it was quite a creeping change, but really we've already seen quite a significant change between your qualification in 1985 and your deciding to give it a break in 97.
Yeah.
I mean, already a lot of things had changed to the point where even with your commitment, you felt that it was necessary to go and do something else. But
Very much so. Very much so. And I think there is one of the things that's noticeable, I guess, is for me, I so clearly accepted the values of the code of conduct. Originally in Ireland, the registering body was called On Board All Tronish. And in this country it was the UKCC, now the NMC. And there's quite a detailed code of conduct about your professional behavior and your attitude to your patients and how you communicate and how you behave in all ways like a professional. And I think as a result of having that code behind me, it enabled me to be quite fearless, so that in situations where I was challenged or where a patient was placed at risk, there were two things. One was my genuine desire to make sure my patients came to no harm, but the other was the certainty that if a patient came to harm while they were in my care, I would be held accountable by my professional body and perhaps be struck off the register. So I really felt very empowered to speak up for my patients and to speak up for my staff and to speak up to my managers and people who really didn't want me to speak up, because there was that kind of strong backbone behind my practice.
And it's an important responsibility to have that kind of backing to be able to enact, isn't it? Because if you're working in that kind of position, you are, if you like, the kind of spine of the group. You are the person who makes sure that they don't get unfairly treated.
Yeah. I think that if you take your position of responsibility seriously, which I did, then I think you also become responsible for making sure that your staff aren't bullied, that they get their breaks, that they get off work on time and get to go back to their families, all sorts of things like that. And sometimes what that would mean is that you wouldn't be able to just keep operating endlessly into the night when a surgeon might say, let's do that, and might call a manager to try and force you into keeping your staff on duty and really affecting their home lives. And this was long before the jargon, the phrase keeping a work-life balance ever came into kind of common parlance in the NHS.
I guess the situation had to get pretty extreme before they started admitting to it.
Yeah. It's true. And I think that what people were finding was nursing is a stressful job, and then because you're dealing with life and death situations all the time, and even in the quietest of areas, people die occasionally. And naturally, you can't cure everybody, and we're not supposed to cure everybody. People come to the end of their lives, and in that circumstance, you would like to think that you can help a person meet the end of their life with dignity. And you accept that, but that can be kind of very distressing for staff. And in operating theatres, like other high dependency areas, you're going to see more stressful things. You're going to see people who've had terrible accidents, and you're going to see people cut open. And some of that stuff is quite traumatic. And again, long before the phrase post-traumatic stress disorder existed, I am sure that there were medical staff, nursing staff and others who were very distressed and traumatized by some of the things that they witnessed.
I think it has been demonstrated, hasn't it, that the people who are more likely to care are in a sense more likely to become chemically distressed by what they see.
Yeah, I can believe it. And I think that how that originally manifested itself, and this is interesting, I think, is that when you become stressed, you are more prone to illness. And if you're prone to illness, you're not going to be at work, and that costs the employer money. And so, of course, they investigate this. Back pain is an occupational hazard of nursing. Hypertension, irritable bowel syndrome, all of these are things that you find in nurses. With medicine, they ascribe the four D's to the profession, drink, drugs, divorce, and death, because it's a lonely and stressful occupation, particularly in hospitals. And I think some of that would also apply to nurses. I know many nurses who, at the end of a shift, where perhaps they've worked many hours longer than their shift that they're scheduled for, they're so unable to just wind down that they consume a bottle of wine. You know, that's how you get to sleep. And that, I think at one point that was considered to be just, you know, that's kind of typical nurses. They like a drink, but in fact now I think it's seen to be self-medicating. It's helping you to just come to terms with some of the stresses you're dealing with in your working life, which is appalling in hindsight.
Yeah.
I see how dysfunctional it is. When I was there, it was the norm.
That's funny that, isn't it? I think that's quite an important point, that that when you're in amongst it, it seems normal, and it's only with a little bit of distance and a little bit of hindsight and a bit of different experience that you can see it. And sometimes that takes years. I've experienced that myself.
Yeah, I remember saying to somebody that in order to deal with some of the stuff that you see, the traumas, that you have to cut off some of your responses in order to be able to cope with your day-to-day work, that you, in order to be able to deal with patients who perhaps have terminal conditions, or if you work in a particular area where the survival rate after certain surgeries is very low, that if what you do is you just compartmentalize that, you put that somewhere away and you just don't deal with it. And you think that that enables you to be able to work and function in a very professional way, so that you're not breaking down in tears and you're not very emotional at work, because that would be so unhelpful and unsafe for patients also. So I think that was probably a failing in the nurse training, is how to cope with the loss of a patient that you've become friends with.
As a matter of interest, I mean, in, say, a more enlightened world, or in a world that was differently resourced, I would imagine that sort of thing could be countered by giving people some training in meditation and yoga, and giving them access to some complementary therapies like massage and all of that. It's not necessary for this to be the case, is it?
I agree. I don't know about the complementary therapies, because in fact the NHS has introduced that, various hospitals have introduced that here and there, and I think by the time they've done that, it's a bit of a band-aid.
Yeah.
And I think perhaps, just like they're talking about introducing meditation to schools, I think teaching student nurses and indeed staff in hospitals how to meditate, how to watch their mind, and, you know, have periods of quiet mind would really help to deal with stress. And I understand that there are a few hospitals that are looking at providing that sort of training to staff now. Because again, staff sickness and rates of absenteeism is costing the NHS millions and millions. I can't even imagine how much it costs, but it's a huge cost to the NHS.
It would be in their interest to do something about it, I would imagine. And I mean, yeah. I know that I once came across a book called The Art of Changing, which explained to me how it was about the Alexander technique, and was specifically aimed at the kind of pains that I had in back and limbs and stuff. And it taught me that by just lying down on the floor flat for 20 minutes a couple of times a day and doing it carefully and getting up again, that I could make a significant difference to the way my back felt, and that actually I'd be much better going and lying down on the floor than going and having a cigarette and a cup of tea in the tea room or what have you. And it really did make a difference. It was one of the most fundamental changes in my life, just simply taking the stress off my back for 20 minutes in the middle of the day. And if it's true physically, it must be even more so psychologically, that if you get if you could have these little gaps, times to gather yourself, then you'd stand a better chance of surviving the experience.
I think the only time I ever lay down at work, Nick, sadly, was when I had just run upstairs to go to the operating theatre and I trapped a nerve. I had to lie on the floor in a clinical room somewhere until the spasm wore away sufficiently that I could get home. My back, I think it's interesting. so many of the possible explanations for why backs go, and I think by which I mean people incur spinal injury. One of them, of course, is that when I was training, nurses did a huge amount of lifting of patients, and really unsafely. So they were only just starting to introduce safe lifting techniques. This is before even all of the equipment came in to help you lift more safely. But apart from the kind of the physical strain on your body, I think the lack of support, the sense of isolation, and the amount of pressure that you were under all caused stress on the spine. That support system for your back was constantly under pressure.
Yeah.
And I think, unfortunately, I guess I haven't really related to this too much. I think as it's such a female-dominated profession, and interestingly, sidebar, many of the managers and senior people are men. So even in this female-dominated profession, there's still that imbalance in the senior positions where many of them are men. But I think there is a huge amount of bullying in nursing. You can have very cliquey teams of women working together. You can have people being very petty and difficult. And I think that can also contribute to a culture of fear and kind of covering up in these places, where if you just get the wrong mix of people working together, really serious abuses can happen, where people either leave very quickly because they're driven out, or their health suffers, or they're bullied, or they're pursued, and a complaint eventually is constructed against them, and they're chased out of there. And that also seems to be common in the nursing profession, and it's acknowledged within the nursing profession.
Yeah, well, I mean, if the primary interest of something that is evidently, in an ideal world, should be a caring profession, if the primary interest is no longer necessarily the primacy of the patient, it is by definition something that is hidden or kind of is not being openly admitted to, and that I think that inevitably leads to little groups who are just looking after their own corner in those circumstances.
You tried
a private hospital for a while, didn't you? Were you there for very long? What did you find in comparison to the decline you'd experienced?
Yeah, it was really interesting. After I'd finished my degree, my arts degree, rather than my nursing degree, yeah. I really, this is a terrible thing to say, I'm sure. I really felt nursing degrees weren't worth the paper they were written on. You had people kind of hobble out of university completely unfit for purpose. You really, it was as if you had to start their training. And they might be very intelligent people. They just had no idea to do the tasks of work.
And in fairness, I hear about this generally, actually, because I know a lot of people who are trying to, you know, one way or another get this cleaned or that tidied up. And they find that this is the case. I hear it a lot that the people that are arriving to be trained for specific jobs don't have the basic skill sets necessary even to be trained, let alone do the job.
Yeah, unfortunately. So anyway, I finished my degree, and my plan was to teach art and to make my living as an artist and doing that. I had enjoyed it so much. I felt like I had entered an atmosphere with a much higher concentration of oxygen and stimulation.
Did you get time to get any work doing that?
I briefly taught in a boys' secondary school in the East End of London, which was horrific, by the way. That really immediately put me off my ideas of teaching.
A completely other story, that one.
There was some film I had just watched with Michelle Pfeiffer. I can't remember what it was called. Anyway, I was quite inspired. I thought, I could do this. I could change the lives of students by teaching them art. And oh my God, I'd never, as a girl, I'd only gone to convent schools. So I never really had much to do with teenage boys ever. So to be suddenly teaching them was just a horrific experience.
It's quite a huge change, isn't it, to move from doing the hospital thing and all that you've described that entails into the freedom of an art degree and then into an East End boys' school.
Yeah, to give them their due, though, there were a lot of kids in that school who had special needs. English wasn't their first language. A lot of them came from single-parent families, or they were the carers of a sick parent. So really, in terms of having a tough start in their life, these boys had really a poor expected outcome. There were huge problems with drugs in that area, all sorts of things. It was very depressing. So I won't dwell on it. After 3 months, I thought, I'm not staying here. And at that stage, I moved to Birmingham. I had an aunt who I'd always gotten on very well with, and she had developed dementia, vascular dementia. So I came up here to be her full-time carer. And after about a year, she needed to be admitted to a nursing home. She'd just become more and more confused, and there just wasn't the support available for me to continue looking after her at home. So at that stage, I really, completely due to financial necessity, got a job in a local private hospital. And that was incredible too. It was completely different to my experience at the NHS. All of the equipment was really modern, and you worked with only consultant surgeons. So in the NHS, you have a consultant surgeon, you have a senior registrar, a house officer, senior house officer, all sorts of students. Whereas you're working with people who are pretty much, hopefully, at the top of their profession. And the pace is very different. It's absolutely driven by money. So everything that you do has a charge to it. Every medicine you administer, every dressing that you apply, there's a cost to it. And at one point, there were lists that you would tick all of the things that you used. Eventually, they made that much more efficient so that there'd be a kind of a package for a particular procedure. So you didn't have to do all the ticking, but everything was documented very clearly. And I think the reason for that was that within private medicine, there is that American culture of litigation. If there is any way for the insurance company to avoid paying for the operation, if a patient comes to any harm, if there's any complication, then they will kind of argue the toss with the hospital. So their standard of documentation of at every level. So when a patient comes into the operating theatre, there are all sorts of, I mean, really excessive amounts of documentation. But in a way, it's a good discipline to learn because the thing that's really emphasised is, if you don't document that you've done something in a court of law, or you know, where these cases come to be argued, if it's not documented, it's not considered to have happened.
Yeah.
So when you get into that, and while it's kind of it's tiring, and often you think I should be doing patient care here, but instead I'm writing notes, and some of them perhaps don't feel necessary, but the hospital requires staff to do this. It is a good discipline because you get into the habit of documenting everything. So every patient intervention that you do, every action that you take, every meeting that you have with a member of staff, even, you document all of this. One of the other things that was particularly good was, in my opinion, the way they dealt with incidents and accidents was really top-notch. There was a sister in the operating theatres. And in fact, every department had somebody whose role it was to investigate an incident. So an incident could be anything. It could be that the power went off. It could be that somebody fell. It could be that somebody died. There are various kind of levels of incidents. But there could also be a near miss. This happened, and if it had not gone unnoticed, worst case scenario, something awful could have happened. So there were all sorts of categories. And every member of staff was expected to fill out an incident form or a statement, and then that person would, the person whose job it was to investigate it, would meet with all the staff involved within probably, if they were on duty, within a week, and they would write a report of their investigation and an action plan. And that would be sent to the matron, and it would also be sent to the head office for kind of collation in the national collection of incident report data. And what would happen after that is once a quarter, an information pamphlet, I suppose, would be distributed for all of the staff, and every single incident that had happened in any hospital belonging to that particular company would be described. And it would be really in simple format. It would briefly describe the incident. Briefly, how had it come to happen? what could be done next time, what the action was. And everybody knew about it so that everybody learned from the incident. You know, everybody didn't have to go through the trauma of having an accident or an incident to learn from it. So it was really disseminated incredibly widely. And as a result of it, I think our standards of safety improved constantly.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes.
So I guess that was quite different to my previous experience in the NHS. I think that what was shocking was when I went back into the NHS, it was just nothing like that at all.
Yeah. Another real cold bath. What was the, just as a matter of interest, what was the private hospital like in terms of like intensity of use? Because my impression is of the NHS from people I know who spend a lot of time there, that there's many that there's, you know, they're trying to run 98% occupancy, and there's always far too many people coming through the door, or many times too many people coming through the door to be dealt with effectively. Is that sort of generally true of the NHS, and was it any less true of the private place?
I think certainly from the point of view that they organized the time slots so that there was a morning operating time, an afternoon operating time, and an evening operating time. And we should always have been finished by 9 p.m. That's when we should have been leaving the building. I think there was probably a year where I was rarely home, if I was on duty that day, before 11. So that was, you would rarely cancel a patient. For example, you know, there was just no room for that to happen. And there was certainly no support from the management if you wanted at 9 o'clock to say, listen, we're all exhausted. We've all been on duty since 8 a.m. We need to stop. And they'd go, no, we'll pay overtime. You have to stay. We can't cancel the patients. Bring in the on-call team, whatever it would be. So in that respect, if it was possible to keep all the operating theatres functioning, if we had the equipment that we needed, then they really did try and utilise it as well as possible. Not necessarily, and that's not necessarily safely, but from their point of view, if it was there and it could be used, then they'd use it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. Okay. Yeah, it does. It sounds like, broadly speaking, like any sort of, because it sounds like a more, to me it sounds like a more industrial process, because I've worked for companies that are regulated by the Food and Drugs Administration in America, and we had to do the same thing. Absolutely everything that happened was documented, and by and large mistakes were dealt with in the same way as well. There was a fairly open way, but I think that clearly if you've got that kind of level of documentation, you also, they're probably managing to exert a bit more control over their throughput of patients, because they don't normally deal with accidents and emergency and things like that, do they?
I hope not. Do you mean private hospitals?
Yeah.
Or the food?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no, the FDA. No, the private hospitals.
Well, you know what? I think, it's just gone out of my mind. My train of thought suddenly interrupted.
It does happen. Sometimes it comes back, sometimes it doesn't.
Yes, I'm sure it will. I'm sure whatever I was about to say was, okay, I remembered. I think the other thing, hand in hand with the need for efficiency, was a measure of their performance was patient satisfaction. So despite the fact that there was a lot of busyness, there was still a culture where the managers really wanted to, and the business really wanted patients to feel cared for. And I guess that is one of the unusual things about the caring profession, whether it's in the private sector or the NHS, is that while we walk into a room where there's a patient and we are caring towards them and their family, when it comes to ourselves and our team and our employees, while I might try and look after my team, I think often I don't believe my employers are interested in looking after me at all, or indeed my colleagues. They want to wring every last drop of work out of us. And that's unfortunate, but still there's that kind of weird thing where even though we were being so efficient, it really did feel like we were looking after the patients and giving them a better quality of care than I had seen, particularly in the operating theatres, than I had seen in other places.
And that was largely, we reckon, down to, well, I suppose, profits and fear of litigation. But nonetheless, it did seem to have the effect that things ran a little bit more smoothly.
Yeah, and I guess the difference between wards and operating theatres is you really are looking after patients one at a time. I was a sister in the recovery unit there, the post-anesthetic care unit, and you had to keep patients generally for a minimum of 20 minutes after they'd woken up from their anesthetic. So generally they're there for at least half an hour, sometimes for hours and hours, depending on their condition. But in that half an hour, you had a good opportunity to really connect with the person, to really ensure that they were comfortable and that you were managing their pain very well, and that you had the time to give them one-to-one care and really connect with them. Whereas I think in other places, you perhaps would be expected to have your patient out of there in 20 minutes, and perhaps managing their pain wouldn't be quite so much of a priority. And you might be looking after two patients simultaneously, and depending on their level of dependency or need, that can be very tricky.
Yeah.
And difficult to do. And depending on how well qualified your staff are, if you have a good team who know what they're doing, they're well qualified and experienced, then that's easy to manage. But if you have people who are not properly qualified, aren't good communicators, if you're not sure about their safety to practice, then that can be awful.
Yes, yeah, because it means you can't concentrate entirely on what you're doing necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the most important things in patient safety is staff skill mix in some of those situations. And I've worked in situations where I really haven't had enough people with me, you know, where I might want a team of five, there's only three of us. But because the three of us are so good, actually our day goes more efficiently than if there'd been five of us. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I do. Yes, I know exactly what you mean.
Whereas on another occasion, if you have the wrong people, then nobody gets their breaks, things get lost, the wrong things get open. Oh, it's like the Keystone Cops sometimes. It's hard to believe that a group of people who are all supposedly qualified can screw up so badly.
Yeah, it is.
So your skill mix is crucial. And as a manager, that is one of your responsibilities, to ensure that you have a good skill mix distributed around the different theatres so that patients are safe, so that the teams feel well supported.
So were you managing several theatres then?
When I worked in London, if I was on duty at a weekend, then I would be managing a few theatres. But during the week, Monday to Friday, I'd probably only be managing one. When I was in private sector, I worked in a recovery unit. And that wasn't a very big unit. And probably at maximum, we would have six people in there with three or four staff, providing care for those. So it could be busy. And often what you would find is that there would be peaks and troughs of activity, and that's when you would take your breaks. Not necessarily every 3 hours, when perhaps you should have a break and rehydrate yourself, but just to make sure that if there was somebody who perhaps was not as qualified, not as skilled or safe as you'd like, that you can supervise them or support them when they're looking after a patient.
That sounds like a relatively satisfying job. Although still hard, I would imagine, after the artwork.
Yeah, but also there's something quite fulfilling about it. And I think the thing that was really interesting for me was I had always, up until then, mostly been dealing with unconscious patients, people who'd been having a general anaesthetic. So although I was giving all this nursing care, probably my patients weren't aware of who I was or how I had kind of participated in their journey through theatres. Whereas when I worked in the recovery unit, often I would meet the patient before they had their anaesthetic, and I'd be with them as they were having their anaesthetic before their surgery, and then I'd look after them as they were recovering from it. And I found I really enjoyed looking after the awake patient, probably even much more than I had enjoyed the higher pressure nursing in like assisting a surgeon during a difficult surgery or a major surgery or cardiac or something.
I suppose it's more a human being to human being service, isn't it, when there's an interaction and eye contact. And
yeah, and I think it's amazing. While I had been looking after my aunt, I had studied Reiki in order to kind of care for myself. And I found that some of the things that I had learned about healing and caring really came into use when I was looking after people who were in the recovery unit. And that often the conversation that you would have with somebody and that connection they'd have with a caring stranger was often more healing than whatever surgery they'd have. It felt like energetically that was also a very significant part of their experience.
Yes, I think that's absolutely the case. And I certainly know it can work the other way, because I know a couple of people who've come out of general anaesthetic on back on their ward, and there's been nobody to help out, and it can be very confusing.
Yeah, awful. I mean, I'm really sorry to hear that, because really, we in the private sector, we had kind of discharge criteria, so we couldn't discharge a patient from the operating theatre recovery area to the ward unless their pain score was under a certain level. Mm-hmm. And their consciousness level had to be above a certain level. So ideally, our patients were discharged really feeling quite well and hopefully quite chipper.
Yes.
So the idea that you would wake up feeling confused or in pain and nobody there to kind of talk you through it is a sad reflection.
Yes, indeed. They're definitely amongst the most distressing stories I've heard of experiences within the NHS, those. But it's good to know that somebody's trying to manage it.
Yeah, I mean, I used to have a real thing, probably again, this is also related to my aunt and her confusion, that at one point I was waiting for her outside her room. The nurses went in to change the sheets or something, I don't know. And while they were in there, they didn't speak in English the whole time. And she really started to scream, because in her confused state, she didn't know who they were, she didn't know what they were doing. And they weren't speaking to her saying, Mary, it's us, we're just going to change this. They didn't talk to her or reassure her. And I can't imagine what that must have been like for somebody with dementia. And I can remember when I was working in the private sector, some of my colleagues were speaking in Tagalog, that's the Philippine language, over a patient who was just coming round. And I really couldn't understand why they felt the need to be ignoring the patient and talking to each other. I mean, I think like that's commonly accepted as unprofessional practice.
And I think with good reason, because if you're in a disassociated state, anything that people can do to keep you associated with yourself and even, you know, your idea of your surroundings rather than even necessarily your actual surroundings is crucial, absolutely critical.
Yeah, and I think that you do, again, you need a certain attitude to your profession. When I was a student nurse, probably when I was in first or second year, somebody said to me, I was complaining about how unfriendly the staff were and how difficult I was finding it to work there. And she said, you just need to remember you're not here to be popular. She said, I don't have any friends at work. My friends are all outside the workplace. I'm here to do my job. I'm here to look after patients. I'm not here to be their friends. And if I have to manage somebody, if somebody's performance is poor, then if I am too friendly with them, it will create difficulty in the workplace. So I maintain very professional relationships with the people I work with. And I remember thinking that is a really good attitude to have in the workplace because it keeps it fairly uncomplicated. And when you have some sort of hierarchical structure in the best possible way, where perhaps the most knowledgeable person is the one who's directing activities or arranging how the work is done. If they see somebody behaving in a way that's unprofessional, they can quite, within their rights and authority, quite fearlessly go and say, in this unit, when you're treating a patient, you will speak English at all times. On your breaks, in the changing room, you can do what you like, but when you are delivering patient care, you must speak in English.
Yeah.
Unless the patient understands what you're saying, then speak to the patient and give them reassurance in their own language.
Yeah.
But I think that there are a lot of nurse managers and managers in general who are very afraid to do that.
Yeah.
You know, they're more concerned with being popular. And again, there's something wrong in the education and training of nurses. As they kind of go up, as they're promoted, sometimes they don't get the training, education, and preparation for the management role that would enable them to maintain those standards. And again, you kind of have that slow dilution of good standard practice, good safe practice, good professional practice, as that happens.
And they're very difficult competencies to train into people, they are.
Yeah, they really are. And I think it's a peculiar thing that I noticed in the hospital where I had all of my difficulty was that you often had people being promoted to junior sister level who were really inexperienced. They might have come from some other background before they'd come into working in hospitals. But I think I had been I'd trained as a general nurse, and I had worked as a staff nurse for about 4 years before I started working in operating theatres. And then I worked for another probably 5 years before I got my first sister's job. So I was merely working as a nurse 10 years before I had any management responsibility. Whereas a lot of the people who got junior sister's jobs and are expected to be able to manage have only recently qualified. They're only 2 or 3 years after their qualification, and suddenly they have this other responsibility thrust upon them. And while there might be some training, they haven't got the actual experience of working with people in those stressful circumstances.
And of course, many of the people they're working with will have more experience than they've got.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And that's really difficult.
It is. Yeah, yeah.
Or would you have hung around in the private, given the differences between the two, would you have hung around in the private service if you hadn't been ushered out?
Well, the story of my being ushered out is interesting too, I suppose. There was a woman who had been working as a bank nurse. So that's somebody who, as and when we're short-staffed, if she's available, we would employ her to work certain shifts. And she's quite an elderly woman approaching the end of her career, and she was really very deaf. And she was not particularly competent in clinical area, but she'd been working there since long before I had ever appeared on the scene. She'd probably been working there longer than most people had. So she was like mold on the walls, frankly. And the manager before me had never dealt with her, you know, and I think often her strategy was to really become very socially involved with people so that they looked after her and stopped her from making any terrible mistakes, but also were very uncomfortable about dealing with her performance, you know, her poor clinical performance. And when I was promoted to the sister in that unit, lots of the team, the full-time team, complained about her a lot and were very concerned about her safety. And one of the things that you really need to be able to hear in the recovery unit is the sound of somebody breathing. It's often your first indication that there's a problem with somebody's airway is that there's a change in the sound of their breath. And she couldn't hear it. And often she couldn't hear it if somebody kind of quietly said, nurse, she couldn't hear it unless she was facing them. So eventually I stopped booking her to work in the recovery unit and explained why, that really I was concerned that her hearing would lead to an injury of a patient. And either the patient would come to harm or she and somebody who she worked with would get into trouble. And she took out a grievance against me because of that. She was encouraged by my manager to take out a grievance against me for doing that. And when it was investigated, the matron insisted that she be employed to work in the recovery unit. And I was very concerned about that. And while I was off sick following that incident, or that experience, my post was made redundant. So that's how I came to leave the private sector.
So that was effectively your first real encounter with the system as it actually works, probably, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
They don't like stroppy slaves.
Well, I think up until then, I hadn't really realised that following the rules would be a bad thing. And I think if you have other people who appear to follow the rules, and then when you really are following the rules, you demonstrate that they haven't been following the rules, then you undermine them and they feel threatened.
Well, this is the important thing, isn't it, really, is that up to now in the private hospital, at least, we've outlined a series of events which seems intended to ensure that such difficulties are brought to the fore, and that by and large that appears to have worked pretty well. But there seems to be a point at which you're regarded as, rather than bringing something to people's attention, you're suddenly regarded as a nuisance, and there's no line. Nobody's telling you where that line is.
Well, I think human nature comes into it to a certain extent. I had probably one or two experiences prior to that in that hospital where I had to stand up for myself quite assertively. So in one, I was working with this guy who really seemed to have a problem working with women, taking orders from women, which is a difficult problem to have if you're working with nurses.
Yeah.
And he seemed to have a particular problem with Irish people. So he and I ended up taking out a grievance against him. And while that was being investigated, the person from head office who was investigating it asked me why I wasn't taking out my grievance against my line manager rather than this guy. Because she felt he had managed it so badly that it almost looked as if he was allowing the guy to bully me.
Yeah.
And then there was that incident with member of staff who's deaf. And I think as well, when I was applying for the sister's post, my line manager had already offered it to the guy who was bullying me, even though I was probably better qualified for the job.
Mm-hmm.
And he hadn't advertised it. He had just told this guy he was going to give him the job. So when I questioned this, he said I wasn't suitably qualified. And I told him that if this person was appointed into the post and I wasn't given an equal opportunity to apply, that I would involve my union. So I think at that stage, actually, yeah. I had very clearly marked my card.
Fair enough. Yeah, you'd stepped over a line possibly by saying you were going to call the union in, but you were only insisting on protocol, on due process.
Yeah.
Because the job should have been advertised.
Human nature, you'd like to think that everything will go according to plan, and then human nature will step into it. So this guy, who was my line manager, at one point told me he thought that our problem working with each other was because I really reminded him of his ex-wife. And his attitude to our team was that he was the father and I was the mother, and they were all our children. Which I thought was an extraordinary management position to take with a group of adults.
It's very difficult, that, isn't it, when you're starting to involve people's personal envisioning and kind of mental furniture in how things are running.
Yeah, so there you have an organization that's employed somebody and probably has no idea that that's how that person views their team or their role as this kind of patriarchal figure in the organization.
And of course, if kind of experience and the consequent respect that inevitably arises therefrom is, again, not the main point of focus, then you're going to get people playing politics.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think, this is a plan is like where you start off from and everything starts changing once you try and implement the plan. Once you have personalities coming into it and all of the different factors that affect any activity, we're all different. We all have our different reactions. And if you have a group of people who are perhaps not conscious or aware at all, and lots of hospital staff are like that, unfortunately, they're in the rat race and, they have a mortgage to pay and they don't lose their jobs. They're very afraid of losing their job or getting into trouble.
Yeah.
So that threat constantly exists within the NHS now more than ever. I mean, it's been in existence in the NHS as long as I've been there, but it's just getting worse and worse and worse.
People just trying to put bread on the table.
And I think that's one of the reasons why being the patient advocate is no longer at the forefront of many people's minds, because they're afraid for themselves.
And yet, underlying the whole thing, as you say, there's a code of conduct, there's a system of paperwork which enables you to point out errors, make complaints, launch grievances, whatever it is. All of this stuff is supposedly there to try and enable these kind of comments safely to be made. and as is apparently the Royal College of Nurses and all of that. I think perhaps it'd be a good idea to play a couple of tunes at this stage and then come back to you for your return to the NHS and what happened as a result. Is that okay with you?
That's great, Nick.
Brilliant. Well, I'll just slip on a tune. I will, and I'll be able to talk to you whilst it's playing. So give me a moment and I'll be back with you.
Sure thing.
Everybody, as I'm sure you're aware, you're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on tnsradio.com and scottishsovereignsontheland.ning.com. And I've been talking with Karen about her experience of being a nurse and how it seems to me how massively things have changed in the last just sort of 10, 20 years or so. And we'll come back to that story after a couple of tunes, 5 minutes or so, and we'll be back with you. Call me the only quiet bit I've had for probably some 60 weeks or so. And looks like my levels have gone all quiet again. I'm sure somebody will tell me if that's the case. In the meantime, Karen's still with me. I hope, Karen, you're still there.
I'm here.
Very good. Okay, I'm just, there we go. I found the right, there we go. That's all right. We should be back up to a normal level now. So you were made redundant with a degree of, a degree of kind of fiddling and presume and just sort of making yourself perhaps a little bit too high profile. And so you presumably still needed to make yourself some sort of some gaming tokens from somewhere. So what did you do next?
Well, I applied to work in a couple of places. There was another private hospital nearby, so I tried there for a while, and I was invited to apply to work in Selly Oak Hospital. A friend of mine who'd been my manager previously in the private hospital was now the person responsible for education in the operating theatres there. So she invited me to apply. And initially I applied to work on the bank because I really wasn't sure if I wanted to keep going with nursing. So my original intention was perhaps to work as a complementary therapist. So initially I was thinking I'll do one day a week practicing Reiki and the rest I'll do as nursing. So I tried that for a while. It didn't really work out in the other private hospital because people just kind of messed me around and expected me to be okay about that, you know, like not reliably booking shifts and things like that. And of course you want to organize your time so you can arrange your life. And people just didn't seem to respect that.
Just as a matter of interest, did you get to try the Reiki on the lady you knew who had the dementia?
I did. That was my aunt. So for the next few years, whenever I would visit, I would do Reiki. And I found it was really very useful for her. Often it would be something that had a very calming effect on her. And in fact, even when I had worked in the private hospital, I would often, in conversation with my patients, end up talking about complementary therapies and Reiki and stuff. And people would occasionally ask if I would mind doing some Reiki for them, either preoperatively or postoperatively. Because there's a huge interest in complementary therapies. And often a lot of people have tried a lot of complementary therapies before they finally decide to have surgery. And with some people, it was quite astonishing. Ordinary pharmaceuticals would not work to manage their pain. And within a couple of minutes of having some Reiki, their pain would be gone. It was fantastic. It was a real demonstration to me that it worked, that it was effective.
And you could get away with using that, could you?
Well, I think if the patient requested it, then it wasn't something I necessarily discussed with my managers and asked for permission about.
Cool.
But a lot of the surgeons knew that I did it and would sometimes say, oh, I've injured my back or something's happened. Will you do some Reiki for me? And even when I went into the NHS, it was something that, it was funny, I suppose, a lot of the anaesthetists and surgeons all thought I was a very intelligent person and so couldn't really get their heads around being an intelligent person and also being interested in something like Reiki. So constantly anaesthetists and surgeons would say, okay, try it, let me experience it, and would comment on how if they had an injury, that there was an improvement, or even if there was no injury, that they could feel really incredible heat flowing through my hands when I was
Yeah.
doing it.
See, I find this particularly interesting because I'm aware of other Reiki practitioners, and I'm aware of people who've had Reiki as kind of, if you like, support for treatment within the NHS. And all of them have reported really quite remarkable success, sometimes even quite physical things like healing of scar tissue and all of that. And it seems strange to me that it is now, it's widely acknowledged, as you say, or at least acknowledged amongst some of the professionals you've met. I know GPs who are now getting into it as well. And yet there seems to be no attempt to get it in. There seems to be no overall recognition, even though these people are all working for the same organization.
Well, I think it's such a difficult thing to measure empirically in the way that hospitals, medical staff, nursing staff are used to and now expect to see things that they're going to use be presented to them. That I think that's why there's initial resistance. But in fact, slowly but surely, it is making its way into the health service, wherever that might be. Nearly every hospice has volunteer Reiki practitioners going in and giving Reiki to residents or patients. And there's a fantastic woman in St. George's Hospital in London who, her son was diagnosed with a terminal illness and given a really terrible prognosis of only having 3 months to live. And she started having him treated exclusively with Reiki, and he survived another few years. And as a result of that, she set up, I think it's called the Sunflower Trust, where they're in the Tooting Hospital, St. George's now employs, it's either 5 or 7 Reiki practitioners, and they provide Reiki to patients, to staff, to relatives of patients, to great effectiveness. They're really considered a crucial part of the team. So I think slowly but surely, and I've met Reiki practitioners working in mental health who also are finding it's gradually gaining acceptance. So I think just like acupuncture a few years ago wasn't in the NHS, and now it's everywhere. Everybody does it. Nurses, anaesthetists, they find it so useful in pain management. I think slowly but surely it will make its way into the mainstream.
I think that's absolutely fantastic as a kind of backstory to what we've been talking about so far.
There is hope.
Yeah, well, it's great to hear you say that it's been so widely used. And of course, I think there's implications that not only in its use, but if you're using it with patients, staff and relatives of patients, then there's a much more inclusive and holistic approach to the whole thing starting to dawn.
Well, and in fact, even in Selly Oak Hospital, the senior nurse in the pain team at one point, I was discussing with her the possibility of introducing Reiki for some of the military patients. One of the anaesthetists had kind of really informally suggested that he felt that in many ways the needs of the military patients were not being met, that the drugs weren't quite working, that the other therapies weren't enough, that they were really struggling. And he felt that Reiki perhaps was a way to bridge that gap. And I've recently been qualifying as a trainer in Breathworks, which teaches meditation techniques and other skills to people who suffer from chronic pain or chronic kind of health conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And there are nurses now who are called nurse prescribers, and they're prescribing meditation. And this course, Breathworks, to patients who have chronic pain or depression or stress, because something like only 30% of the patients really have proper relief of symptoms from their drug treatment.
Yeah.
So 70 out of 100 people aren't really having the quality of life that they could have if their needs were being met more holistically. So I think often it is nurses who drive that sort of thing, you know, who really acknowledge there's something that they use perhaps outside, because lots of nurses are complementary therapists. They've studied reflexology, aromatherapy, Reiki, various things, and find that when they introduce it into their area, quite informally initially, and then maybe introduce trials, again, this kind of empirical way of introducing change into the NHS, that it does get accepted.
I find that really encouraging. I really do. A friend of mine in the West Midlands does work kind of in hospices and with GPs, and she demonstrates things like Indian head massage and kinesiology and Reiki to them, and is having incredible success. So, I mean, that's, if you like, I think it's really brilliant that there's this kind of undercurrent. Whilst we've been talking about a kind of slow, well, fairly rapid decline of the official system, and also really, in a way, I'd call the dispossession of our nurses of their rightful role. They're still managing to get new information in there and get new effects rippling around the base of the system, which is tremendously encouraging.
Well, I guess you've just reminded me of a story that was in the news maybe 2 or 3 years ago about obstetricians in America trying to ensure that midwives could no longer be the sole person present, professional healthcare professional present during a birth, because so many women were choosing to have their birth managed by midwives that they were losing a fortune. So there was an attempt to make it illegal. And it almost kind of harks back to medieval times where women were being perceived as a threat to the patriarchy. And I sometimes think that perhaps something similar exists with nurses and with complementary therapy, that there is anecdotal evidence and experience related by patients to doctors, and that this works, and often the person who's tried it is female. And I wonder sometimes if that's part of the resistance, that if I can fix you, if I can heal you and you don't need to have medication, if a change in your lifestyle can mean that you don't need a stent put into a coronary artery or a coronary artery bypass graft being put in, I am literally taking the money from a cardiologist's pocket.
Yeah.
So, of course, if I'm going to affect somebody's wealth, capacity to earn, then there's going to be great resistance. So maybe we're not quite there yet, but I think that is a factor in the resistance to complementary therapy.
I think you're right. And, of course, that drive to earn, or perhaps more accurately, the drive to keep paying the mortgage, keep paying the bills, keep paying for the child minding, putting food on the table, paying for the water, or paying for the foreign wars, all this other stuff, it's now worked its way quite the way down to the shop floor, hasn't it? Everybody is now at the point where really their need to earn is in some way kind of overcoming the rigorousness of the systems put in place to try and manage errors.
I'm not sure that I follow the link to the last part there.
Right, that basically it's no longer just the management who are having their wealth threatened if they challenge the system, but it's now at the point where many people feel threatened, feel that their wealth, that their ability to earn is threatened if they should buck against the system, shall we say.
Well, and I think also this culture of spending, the aspirational lifestyle, I must have a car, I must go on holidays, I must own a designer clothes or whatever, handbag. I think that a lot of nurses are in debt. Their wages are inadequate. Nurses' pay rises have not kept abreast of inflation since I was involved in pay negotiations in 95. Mm. I mean, really, nursing unions are, I have not a good word to say about nurse unions. In terms of a compliant representation of a group of workers, I haven't a good word to say about the unions involved supporting the healthcare professions, because they've failed them utterly.
Because you did eventually get personal experience of this. I mean, as well as watching other people's cases, in the long run, you were providing too much paperwork, weren't you, for Sally Oak, and got yourself into a bit of difficulty there.
Well, do you want me to talk about that now?
Yeah, go for it.
Move along to that. When I moved to Selly Oak Hospital, initially I was as a bank nurse. I wasn't allocated a specific theatre or a specific line manager, so I've moved several times during a day or a week from one theatre to another. And one of the things that I noticed really quickly was that staff, that there were certain staff who just weren't complying with standard health and safety, not even health and safety, safe practices. So, for example, every operating theatre that does elective surgery should have an operating list provided to it at the beginning of the morning. And you base your work around that, who your staff are, how you manage the work to the team, what equipment that you prepare in the operating theatre, all this sort of thing is based on that. And you send for a particular patient as the first on the operating list, and you have their identity details, so their name, their date of birth, they have a hospital number, the operation they expect to do, and where that operation site is. And all of those things are sent to the ward on a slip of paper, and then hopefully the correct patient is brought back to you. And you check all those things again before you let the ward nurse go away. You check you have the right patient, you know what operation they're having, if they have any allergies, if they've, when did they last eat, all of these things. Then they come into the anaesthetic room, and that's usually done again with the anaesthetist. And then it's done again with the scrub nurse. So the scrub nurse is kind of your final line. This is the person who should make sure that you have the right person having the correct operation on the correct site, that you've got all your information correct. And then hopefully a safe operation will take place and finish. The patient will leave with no injury. And what I was noticing initially was that when the patient would come in, staff wouldn't always check the consent form. So that is a problem, because if you haven't checked the consent form, you're not going to notice if the patient has signed for, let's say, an operation on their right arm rather than their left arm.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to notice if it's correct. So I might be expecting to do a skin graft, let's say, on one arm, and on the consent form it might say a removal of a scar or an exploration of a wound, something else.
Yeah.
So I need to check it just to know what I'm doing and who I'm doing it to. And if there's any discrepancy between what's on the consent form and the list, I have to check with that. So not doing that simple thing is very risky, because it also usually means you're not checking their name band, because you should check these things simultaneously, the consent form, the name band, against the operating list. So if you're not checking that, potentially you have the wrong patient on the table, or potentially you're about to do the wrong operation.
Yeah.
On the patient. So to notice that is pretty worrying. And it was something, because I didn't have a line manager, I would speak to my friend. I had a friend who was a sister there, and say, you know, is this common, or who should I report this to, or what should I do about this?
So you were very sensibly trying to feel the texture of the ground, as it were.
Yeah, and eventually there was one particular person who I had witnessed her refusing to do an instrument count at the end of an operation. So it's possible to leave an instrument inside a patient by accident. You know, I told you the little anecdotal story of when I was a much younger nurse in London, that had happened. So it's something I'm keenly aware of. And indeed, I have seen and heard of other incidents where swabs have been left inside patients. So it's very serious. And I had taken my students, when I was in London, I used to take my students to the coroner's court just so that they could see what happened there after a patient had died following surgery.
Yeah.
And often, the experience for the person who had been involved in the operation was really grueling. You know, you were often treated with great hostility by the coroner. She had to explain how had you screwed up if you had screwed up. So these are all very good reasons to avoid making that sort of mistake. Apart from the fact that you don't harm to come to anybody, there are other good reasons to avoid making mistakes. So for somebody to kind of just assume that they were good enough to never make a mistake, and also that they were big enough or difficult enough to bully other people into going along with that, you know, not doing the count. So this is really serious. So when I found myself in that situation, I said, okay, you need to understand, if you're not going to do this count, then I will not be signing any of your documentation. I'll be filling out an instant form and reporting you to the theatre manager. So, of course, she did the count. But probably not many people would have stood up to her in that way. So I reported it to the theatre manager, and she said, oh, I know, she's terrible, but she's going to be retiring soon. There's really no point in taking her down the disciplinary route because she'll be gone soon. And there was often that sort of response when I would report something informally. And if I must be completely truthful, for the first couple of months, if I noticed something, then I would have an informal conversation with either the nurse manager, the sister in charge of that particular operating theatre, or whoever was running it. I would have a conversation with them so that it didn't take on too serious, too formal a kind of a route.
Yeah.
But then it was happening so frequently that I was becoming so concerned about it that I realized I had to start documenting it and using incident forms. I had this belief. Is this true? I had a delusion, I think, that if I spoke to the people in charge, that they would do something about it.
Yeah.
Because certainly when I had been a nursing sister, if somebody came to me and said, somebody won't do a count, then I would sort that out. I would explain to them it had been reported to me. I would explain it was a disciplinary offence not to follow this procedure. And that I'd be monitoring, like to consider themselves warned, really. It was so serious. So my assumption was every other sister would do the same thing. And probably up until that point, in my experience, most of my colleagues, when faced with that sort of report, would take that same action.
Of course, you'd had a bit of a break, hadn't you, from the NHS at this point? So things had moved on whilst you'd been gone.
Well, also, I was working, when I was in London, I was working in a top teaching hospital, King's College Hospital, top teaching hospital.
Yeah.
I was just looking through some of my records and I was given a copy of the Hansard report, the kind of official report of parliamentary debates for April 2010. And on that particular debate, they were talking, in one of their debates, they were talking about the CQC and its reliance on information provided to it by the Dr. Foster report.
That's the Care Quality Commission.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which, I guess my experience of the Care Quality Commission, and before that it was the, what was it, the HCC, I think it was, before it changed its name.
Yeah.
That in the private sector, actually it is really hot on the private sector. You get a visit a year and they are very strict visits and they observe in the clinical area the practices that happen, and really it's all stations, all hands on deck when the CQC go into a private hospital, you know, everything. This is one of the reasons why I think I had some faith in the CQC when I went from the private sector into the NHS, because it had worked so effectively in the private sector. But that was not my experience once I moved into the NHS, but I don't want to give any spoilers at this point. But anyway, in this 2010 Hansard report, Selly Oak Hospital, or rather UHB Hospital, is listed as one of the 19 worst performing hospitals in the country. There are 19 that are listed, and they have the highest mortality rates. So I think that what I was witnessing in that hospital is not what happens in the excellent hospitals, because there are excellent hospitals. We read about what happened in Staffordshire Hospital, awful. Mm. And Bristol Infirmary, awful. There are awful, awful stories. But actually, there are some great nurses. There are some great managers. There are some great teams. Just this particular hospital, the culture of the organization doesn't, and certainly didn't when I was there, support safe, open practices.
Mm.
Very disappointing. It was a real shattering of an illusion. The whole experience was quite a shattering of an illusion. Anyway, I digress.
So what happened when you started? Because I mean, that's the way I would have approached it as well, as human being to human being, try and feel the pulse of what's going on at the place and trying to deal with people on an individual level, like you say, living heart to living heart. And you only really reach, don't you, for bits of paper and all of that if that's not working.
Yeah, exactly. I think I still had faith in human nature at that stage, or at least in the human nature of those people. But what I was discovering, there were a few sympathetic souls there, and when I would talk to them, they would kind of really seem to enjoy being in the presence of somebody who kind of came from a similar background to them, who had similar standards or values to them, but would just say, don't bother. You are wasting your time. You are banging your head against a brick wall. Nothing will change here. And that was kind of disheartening, but equally, I really felt, well, I'm not going to comply with this. You know, I'm not going to fall into this demotivated state of, I'm trying to come up with an analogy, but really, it really saddened me to see people who could have been me, but who had just given up.
Yeah, because they're effectively asking you to take the money for not doing your job, aren't they?
Well, and I think some of those people did their jobs very well as individuals. Patients were safe when they were with those individuals. But there were other people, many people, who, yeah, and part of it, I think, is the demands placed on some of the G-grade sisters. When I was a G-grade sister in London, certainly I was expected not to be scrubbed at the table all the time because the people who were F-grades and E-grades were sufficiently experienced and competent to be able to do most of the surgical clinical procedures to assist at those. I was expected to be managing and to be supervising or teaching.
Not getting your hands dirty.
Well, there'd be some getting your hands dirty, but I think I was still able to do it and supervise in some capacity so that my staff had my support. But often what would happen there is that the G-grades were pulled out of the operating theatre and they'd have to man the phones or be in the office or do paperwork. So their clinical expertise is pulled out of the clinical area and their confident, assertive professionalism was removed from the equation. And often quite junior people were left to deal with quite difficult surgeons and quite difficult cases.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they weren't able to manage that. And for those G grades, there was a real demand on their everything about their role as a nurse, because they weren't just there to do nursing. They were now there also as a manager.
Yeah.
And that kind of dichotomy, is that the right word?
Yeah, it is.
I think can pull you completely off in the wrong direction. And you can be managed for not performing your management tasks. You can be performance managed and disciplined for failing to meet your targets to do with staff levels or whatever you're responsible for, some of which just seems completely irrelevant to the care of a patient when you're in an area that doesn't have really skilled staff there. And they had a peculiar policy where they wanted staff to be able to work in every area. So a lot of the junior staff were rotated every 3 months. And you might remember I said earlier, actually you need to be in some areas for several years before you really master it.
Yeah.
So if you're moved around every 3 months, you will never master anything. You might be generally good at some stuff, but you won't really be excellent. It's impossible to achieve excellence because there's such differences between general surgery and orthopedic surgery. And there's such a difference between surgery on the hip bone and surgery on the bones in the hand. And it takes a while to get used to all of the different sets of instruments. I mean, really, there's a lot of stuff you have to learn. And you've only just started getting used to the place and you're moved on to the next place. So it doesn't make for good teams, for good teaching. It really increases the stress on the staff who are there a bit more permanently.
And again, it'll make those staff slightly more defensive because they're less assured as to what they're doing.
Yeah. And if you have a sister or what would you call it? A charge nurse is the title for a male version of the sister. If they're not present, then you don't have support. So you don't have somebody teaching you. So even though I was very, very experienced by the time I ended up in the day surgery unit there, actually I hadn't done a lot of this particular type of surgery. So orthopedic hand surgery, emergency or elective. Wasn't familiar. I mean, a little bit like carpentry, if I may be so bold as to say that. Lots of drills and screws and saws and that sort of thing, which I would never use at home, let alone in theatres. So learning all that, there's a steep learning curve. And if you didn't have somebody there who could teach you, it was really difficult. In fact, it's not safe. That's not the way you teach somebody. But that was quite common.
So that means that sometimes there weren't people there necessary. There was sort of a middle chunk of the team missing because it was out administering. And that also means there's nobody there to teach.
Yeah.
So how
interesting. As you know, leaping ahead slightly, I eventually took my case to employment tribunal. And interestingly, without exception, the nurse who was my theatre sister and her managers completely denied that any of this ever happened. And it was, were you going to ask me something?
Surely the time to have denied all of that would have been when the paperwork was raised.
I'm kind of leaping ahead of myself, I suppose.
No, it's cool. There you are in a tribunal saying that all of the, you know, you've been trying across several theatres to bring people's attention to proper procedure, and have been basically ignored by your management, so that you ended up forced to take it to a tribunal, really, because you got sick, didn't you?
Well, that's very nicely put. Essentially, I was moved to the day surgery unit, and in the day surgery unit, it was a team of people who had really developed kind of a siege mentality. They were quite far away from the main operating theatres, and they had recently been through their own trauma. I don't know if you remember this. There was a consultant anaesthetist filmed asleep in the operating theatre while he was supposed to be looking after a patient. And I think there was a further footage of him watching a DVD while there was an operation happening. And the staff had been involved in the investigation into this, and I think it went to the British Medical Association, and they had tried to follow normal protocols. They'd reported it to the theatre manager, they'd reported it to the theatre matron, they'd reported it to the people in charge of the anaesthetic department, and nothing was done. So finally they went to the papers. So at that stage, they also had kind of just given up on trying to make things safer. And in that unit in particular, there were all sorts of problems with safe practice. And we were also just in the process of introducing a new type of anaesthesia. So everything's kind of changing. And in hindsight, it's as if all of the perfect or worst case scenario factors were coming together to create the perfect storm.
Yeah.
You had people, you had a poor skill mix, you had a very weak manager, you had lack of support from senior managers, you had more and more work coming through because it's the regional centre for traumatic hand injury, so patients don't just come from Birmingham area, they come from all over the West Midlands and further afield. You also have the military patients, of course, coming with all sorts of injuries acquired in Iraq and Afghanistan. So the pressure to just keep working was growing stronger and stronger. And you also have people being admitted to casualty. And they had set up a team within the hand service of nurses who would try and coordinate all this so that these patients were being operated on. That's a good idea. But what was happening was that those nurses were writing out operating lists, which is completely contrary to all of the guidelines and policies that are set out. It's supposed to be a surgeon or the surgeon's secretary who produces an operating list, certainly for elective lists, but certainly also to provide all the information necessary for an emergency list. And those lists are meant to be the ones that the work happens from. And often those lists would be incorrect. You wouldn't have the right patient details. You wouldn't have their unit number. You might have a very general description of their operation, so you couldn't prepare the equipment you needed for it. And the order of the list would change constantly. So you might send for the first patient and suddenly be told, oh no, the order has changed, you should be sending for the third patient on that list.
Sounds more like Fawlty Towers than a hospital.
Well, it was like Fawlty Towers with none of the humour. It was really awful.
Mm.
And the potential is that you will carry out the wrong procedure on a person. And sometimes that's a kind of a near miss, that you would have two people who are both having an exploration of a wound, and you know, whoever you do, you're going to explore the wound. So maybe nobody will come to any harm. But with somebody else, you might be planning to do surgery on their right hand, but both hands might be in plaster. And if you're not sure which arm you should be operating on, then you can make a mistake. And in Ireland, and I think that this was something that was really in my consciousness, there had been a case about maybe in 2005 or 6, where a child in the Crumlin Children's Hospital in Dublin was having renal surgery. He was, I think he had one functioning kidney. And as a result of them not carrying out the correct checks for the operation and the identity and everything, they took out his only healthy kidney. So while you might think some of those things that I've listed as safety checks are not that important, if you think potentially you could cut off, you could perform a mastectomy on the wrong breast, you could take out the wrong kidney, you could amputate the wrong limb, you know, the consequences are dreadful. And it was something that I used to say to the staff, you know, we really need to be aware of this. And we did a kind of an informal audit of the consent forms and the operating lists that we were getting through the unit. And on one particular day, we had 9 patients, I think, and 6 of the consent forms were incorrect.
Such that even if people were checking the consent forms, they wouldn't be getting the correct information.
Yeah, yeah.
So you've got no choice to, but I mean, you have to act under circumstances like that, don't you?
Well, and I thought I was following all the policies correctly. You know, I spoke to I was an E grade, so I spoke to my line manager, who was an F grade, but a very inexperienced F grade, and he was suffering from all sorts of stress, did nothing about it. Spoke to the G grade sister, and she was absolutely useless. She said, listen, I spoke to the theatre matron about this months ago. I asked for her help. She did nothing. I can't do anything about it. They're not going to help me. So I spoke to the theatre manager about it, and she just seemed overwhelmed by, I mean, there was just shit coming in it from all directions, if you'll excuse my language.
Yeah.
they were in the process of moving to another site from Selly Oak Hospital to the Queen Elizabeth's new hospital. So a lot of the managers were really involved in other tasks and seemed to have a completely different focus and were under a lot of stress, was the impression I got. So then I met with the theatre matron. And each of these meetings I felt was really, really serious. And that if I had been any of those people listening to somebody telling them what I was telling them, I would really be very, very, very worried. I'd have taken immediate action. There's absolutely nothing. They were just all kind of shrugging. Nothing we can do about it. So at that stage, I contacted my union. And at this stage as well, I was really suffering from all sorts of stress-related illnesses. And
how long, just a matter of interest, how long had you been working away at this problem by now?
I think I went there in March. I really started to kind of feel it, I think, in October, November, mm-hmm. in 2007. I referred myself for counselling with the staff support unit in February or March, and it took about 6 weeks to get my first appointment, and was, you know, really trying to discover why was I being so stressed by this. And it was really very useful. The process of reflection and introspection that's required by good counselling is so helpful and beneficial. I would recommend it to everybody. And it really became apparent when it was pointed out that there was incredible incongruency. I hadn't encountered that word before I met my counsellor. And she said, yes, they're saying one thing and they're doing the opposite. They're saying they're listening to you, but they're not acting. They're saying they're concerned, but they're not changing anything. They're saying they support you, but they're not making any changes that would assist you to feel less stressed.
Yeah.
And I think they were also, a lot of them, very aware of the fact that I was very experienced. So often they'd kind of leave me as if I was in charge. and I would often be left with people who weren't particularly skilled or were just recently qualified and recruited and couldn't really do the work very well.
But also, you can't really be in charge if all of your instruments of feeding back are being ignored.
Indeed.
You're being given the responsibility but no influence.
Yeah. So I went to see my GP. I really thought I was on the edge of a nervous breakdown. I went to see my GP and my GP said, I would really encourage you to let me put work-related stress on this sick note. And she said, and don't wait till you go back. Go and see the person from personnel and speak to them about this and get their support. And it's interesting that she referred to the human resources department as personnel, because once upon a time, the personnel department's role was kind of to look after the staff. But in fact, that's changed now. The human resources role is not to look after the staff. It is to manage that resource. We're not really people. We're a resource now, human resource. So that expectation that the human resources people would deal with me appropriately or instigate some change really was, as shall become apparent later on in the story, a complete mistake. What a fool I was. And then I got in touch with the Royal College of Nursing and asked them, you know, for advice, what could be done in this situation, because it didn't just affect me, it affected my colleagues, and it was a risk to patients. So they said that they would bring it to the staff side and that they would bring it to the Health and Safety Committee, and none of that ever happened. I mean, they completely dropped the ball. They were useless.
So it's no support from the management, or your kind of professional body, or anybody, or the human resources as they're called now.
Yeah.
It must have come as a serial shock.
Well, in hindsight, probably if I had known about the whistleblowing policy at that point, I should have instigated the whistleblowing policy. And although they have an intranet, most hospitals now have an intranet so that staff can access policies and things, I was always so busy at work, I never had time to be on the intranet. Never.
No.
The idea is laughable, in fact. There were other people often, though, who would mess around on the computer and surf the net and stuff when they were at work. I just don't know how they found the time. Or indeed, I mean, had I been their manager, I would have stopped it, but I wasn't. It was allowed. Mm. And again, this is all stuff that was denied at the Employment Tribunal when we discussed this sort of unprofessional behaviour in the operating theatre.
So how did you find out about the whistleblower policy? Because presumably having exhausted any attempt to get information up through any other process, how did that become apparent to you?
Well, I'd finally been off sick, long-term sick, with work-related stress for November, all of November. And nothing had happened. I wasn't getting any responses or reassurance from my managers. So I contacted the staff hotline. And the staff hotline, I imagined, would lead to some sort of swift response. And I guess I thought that was kind of the whistleblowing access, without having the word whistleblower in my mind. So I said who I was and that I wanted to report these unsafe practices. And about a week later, I got a letter saying that this would be delegated to the chief nurse, and that the chief nurse would get in touch with me. And the chief nurse got in touch with me eventually to say, oh, I understand this has all been resolved. And it hadn't been resolved. So I corrected that false impression and said I still wanted to meet and talk about this. Mm. So I finally met with her in March. So imagine that was November, December, January, February, March, nearly 5 months before I met with her.
And had any of these unsafe practices resulted in unsatisfactory results in this period?
Do you mean had anything happened to patients?
Yes.
Well, I'm just looking. I'm just going to click onto this on my computer. I'm just looking at... Can you still hear me?
Yeah, I can, yeah.
Yeah, good. I'm just looking at the statement that I wrote to the Employment Tribunal, and I'll just read it if that's okay.
Yes.
However, in 2008-2009, the hospital injured 18 people, carrying out wrong operations on incorrect sites, leaving instruments inside patients and not noticing that a crucial airway tube had become disconnected, killing a patient. In its most recent publication, the Dr. Foster Report 2009-2010 listed UHB as one of the 19 named hospitals with an alarmingly high death rate. Its statistics show that the national average of post-operative mortality from high-risk procedures is 100. UHB's rate is 113. The national average mortality from low-risk procedures is 100. UHB's rate is 120. Wow. The national average of deaths after surgery is 100. UHB's rate is 157. The national average of post-operative sepsis is 100. UHB's rate is 144. And it goes on like that with these incredible statistics are a reflection of poor practice and unsafe practice.
And one might have expected some kind of urgency in response, but it took ages to get this through, didn't it?
Well, I got that information from the Imperial College, who compiled that report by collecting information from the hospitals in the country. But when I made my complaint to the chief nurse, at that time, Mid-Staffordshire Hospital was in the news constantly, and there was still a part of me that thought, the senior management cannot know about this. If they knew about it, they'd be dealing with it.
Yeah.
So I still had faith in the process. So when I met with her, she asked, are you planning to go down the grievance route here, or are we going to instigate the whistleblowing policy? And I said, well, it must be the whistleblowing policy because there are too many people to try and take a grievance against. And it was interesting at that meeting too, there was a senior HR advisor and she was incredibly antagonistic. So I was really aware any dealings I was having with human resources at this stage, it really felt like I was the enemy. And at one of the employment tribunal hearings, what the judge kept asking the HR person is, why didn't you instigate the whistleblowing policy in August 2008? Was it 2008? Yes, I think so. And the HR person said, well, I didn't know I should do that. And he said, it's really apparent this is a whistleblower. You know, the stuff she was coming to, whether she was right or wrong, this was a whistleblowing policy person. And she said, well, I spoke to my manager about it and she didn't suggest it. And then when the senior HR person was finally cross-examined about this, she said, well, it wasn't my job. I wasn't directly involved in this. And she was informally involved with every single manager at every single stage, but had absolutely no formal responsibility. So I think finally became apparent with the whistleblowing policy is, number one, they don't want people to use it. And number two, even when they use it, what they've done is they've kind of picked somebody out of the herd who is not going to be compliant, rock the boat.
I identified yourself as a target rather than as somebody who's identifying things that need to be sorted.
Yeah, and I think, in fact, that was probably identified that August, long before the whistleblowing policy was instigated or implemented in August. That senior HR person was alert to my existence and this situation. And there was some, when they had to kind of provide full disclosure, they had some correspondence, email correspondence, where it was clear she was involved with the theatre matron, with advising her on how to respond to certain things and saying it's very serious. And they weren't clear about how they were, at that point also, before the meeting with the chief nurse, there was a period of what were they going to do with me? I wasn't at work. I wasn't being paid. Perhaps they should have been trying to redeploy me. And any of the things that I was interested in being redeployed into, they said weren't appropriate. And any of the things that they offered to redeploy me into, I really felt were completely inappropriate. They wanted me to go back on the wards and to work in areas of specialization that I had no experience of.
Yeah. More manoeuvres that were clearly not going to help the situation.
And finally, I think what I realised as this all dragged on, and there was a very long process where an investigation was started into my whistleblowing allegations, and that was being carried out by an employee of the hospital, of the Foundation Trust. So, of course, it was not going to be objective, and of course it was going to be by somebody who was employed by the organisation that was being criticised. So
the idea that this is a proper process is laughable. In hindsight, it's laughable.
I think you did really well to maintain your faith in level after level of it as you tried to reach a resolution.
Oh, I think I was deluded. Don't be impressed with that. I think I was a fool. In hindsight, if anyone else was ever in that situation, I would say, come March time, when I've been off sick for about 4 months, that's the time to resign. That's the time to go to employment tribunal.
Yeah.
And I think that was the question of the employment tribunal. Why did you stick it out? I don't think they could imagine or believe that I still had any faith in the process at that stage. And I really, also in hindsight, I really think I was deeply depressed at that stage. You know, I really wasn't dealing with my life rationally. I got into terrible debt. Wasn't being paid, was really in denial about my finances and wondering what was going to happen with my career. My aunt, who had had dementia, had just died a few months earlier. So there were all sorts of things going on that were, I think, affecting my judgment.
And you had no support at all, in fairness.
Well, I think the RCN were really useless. I think I was hoping that they would provide expert assistance, but often I was the person who was driving communication and action and querying things,
which more or less seems to be in your position from the start, really.
So I completely lost faith in them, and at one point when I was asking, okay, how do we end this, I just want to cut my losses and get on with my life, in fact that request subsequently was kind of used against me, because the hospital's response when I finally went to employment tribunal was to completely ignore the fact that I was a whistleblower, indeed to almost deny that I was a whistleblower, and to say that I was doing this for money, that I was trying to develop my Reiki business, and so this was all being done for money. And I really thought that's such a red herring. I can ignore it.
In a way, though, if everybody else is acting for the money, then they're just projecting that onto you, aren't they?
Well, I was really amazed that they really believed it. And the other thing that was quite incredible to me was one of my best friends, as I said, was working in the education department in that unit. And stuff that she knew about my life and that I'd, you know, the reason that I had parted from the employer, the private hospital, she had given them all this information. That was completely confidential, and it has all been completely warped. So the barristers for the hospital were also implying that I had taken my previous employer to employment tribunal, which was a lie. But planting those seeds in the heads of the panel seemed to really work. So even though that was proven to be false, still it was as if they couldn't believe that anyone would go through all this. For any other reason than money.
So what were their conclusions? What was their judgment in the long run, this panel?
Their judgment in the long run was that, yes, I was indeed a whistleblower, but so what, kind of? It's your job. You're supposed to blow the whistle when things go wrong. But they found that even though the hospital has, I feel really suspiciously, lost all my personnel files. Very early on, they lost all the personnel files. So all of the stuff that would have provided evidence that they had never supported me with my time off sick or managed my absence related to work-related stress, all of that was lost. And that would have proven that they had failed to support me and look after me as an employer. The panel said, oh, that happens sometimes. And even though I had different people come with me throughout the employment tribunal, and on one occasion a policewoman came with me, and she said the body language of the witnesses, it was so apparent that they were lying, that she felt sure the panel would instantly recognize that they had been really well rehearsed by the legal team, and that they were being really evasive, they were being inconsistent and contradicting each other, and just through their body language that they were not telling the truth. But the panel seemed to completely ignore all of that and just chose to believe them. And although there was no evidence, the hospital wasn't able to provide any evidence to contradict my claim for constructive dismissal. They just decided to believe the hospital. And it seems to be that their outcome, their decision was based on opinion rather than fact. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I express that. So in the end, they didn't find in favor of constructive dismissal, and that they felt that the hospital had taken appropriate action and had responded to my complaints, and that I was, they felt I had been arrogant and superior in my expectations of my managers and my colleagues, and very intolerant. And it was really quite incredible. I was kind of, my God, what employment tribunal hearings were you at? This doesn't seem like a description of me, my behavior, or my claim at all.
No. So we've got 8 or 9 minutes left.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, the final outcome was that there was an application for costs by the hospital. And in March, the panel decided that the hospital, I would have to pay the hospital a capped figure of £10,000. So there's no appealing that because there was nothing in law, I think. I think there's no appealing their outcome because there was no point of law that could be appealed, and that's the only way to appeal that. And what I managed to do was scrape together from loans from a couple of friends about £4,500, and I suggested a payment plan to the hospital of £2.50 a week, because I'm still unemployed. I've lost my nursing career at this stage and can't ever imagine working as a nurse again. And I recently got a letter from the hospital's lawyers saying that was a nice gesture, paying the £4,500, but we don't accept this offer at all. We want you to pay the rest of the money in 2 years, or else we'll take you to court and we will try and take your home from you. Or what's the word? Is it a court order?
Yeah, because you made them an offer to pay them £2.50 a week, and they effectively said, no, don't pay us the £2.50 a week, pay us more. Well, I don't know what the TNS crew think about that in terms of the official offer. It seems to me that the lady was
They've taken the £4,500, you know, they've snapped that up.
Yeah.
And they've instructed me to stop paying the £2.50 a week, which I haven't stopped doing because actually it's probably more than I can afford at the moment.
Well, I don't know what the TNS people think of an instruction not to pay the £2.50 a week as opposed to paying the £2.50 a week and performing regularly on the bill. Perhaps somebody might want to put some comments in the chat box on that, because it's just the way. It says debt is now forgiven from Corky in there, because there is a point in law that payment refused is payment made, but it'd be an interesting thing for you to look into that and perhaps try and get some more details.
Yeah, it would be great and comforting to know if that's the case, because certainly the panel gave no maximum time period within which this could be paid. Where they plucked that figure of 2 years from, I don't know.
Well, we'll look into that a little later as things go on, I will, and I'll get back to you on that. What about, because I mean, obviously, this is a tale of dereliction, really, even if it's kind of accidental and casual. That's what's going on. Everybody's shrugging responsibility for everybody else, and somehow a job that's designed to deliver care and help to people is somehow doing exactly the opposite. Have you we only left you a few minutes really, but have you got any ideas as to how some of these things might be sorted out?
I have reflected on this a lot. I think one of the most important things is to reduce the number of incidents that happen. So really enable and empower managers to make sure that they have the right staff, that they have the right skill mix, and then that makes it safer. If you can reduce the number of incidents, then you reduce the costs of that. And if you can improve relations with staff, then you have people who feel confident to do their jobs. I mean, I think that it's really important to address the culture of fear and bullying in the NHS, because that seems to contribute to people being willing to admit that they've made a mistake and to report it and to deal with it. Because one of the guys who was cross-examined, he seemed to think that an incident form meant that we had failed. It was a bad reflection. on the unit. And that's completely the opposite of the intention of reporting incidents. You know, if you're going to have a culture that's transparent and open, you can't have people living in fear of punishment.
No.
And I think it's really important as well, absolutely without doubt, the NHS managers should be prevented from paying fees to whistleblowers to implement gagging orders. Apparently there are hundreds of cases where doctors and nurses or hospital staff have been paid a payoff, really. We'll pay you this amount of money, but you can never acknowledge that we've paid you this amount of money. It's kind of compensation, but we will never admit to it. So the person who's reported it can never speak about it.
So there's
it costs the NHS hundreds of thousands.
Yeah.
And nothing is learned from it. So it seems to be really corrupt. So I think that system just has to end immediately. And I think that hospitals really need to accept that human beings work within the system and human beings make mistakes. And if you're open and acknowledge something has happened, we take responsibility for it and we're going to try and fix it.
And
if somebody's died, then that's difficult. But still, to make some acknowledgement or apology to a family.
Yeah.
And that culture, rather than trying to beat people down or drag things out or make it impossible for them to get answers, and developing this culture of mistrust between patients and the hospital, that just has to change.
Yeah, there needs to be a clarity of aim in the place. And the business, of course, of denying any kind of... Sometimes the patient's families only want an apology, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's brought us to the end of another show, it has, Karen. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for listening.